Welcome to the Do Your Good podcast series. In this podcast series, you'll hear from me, Sybil, and other experts in the field to help you make your money matter and make a huge difference in the world. I come to you with over two decades of experience as a person who's helped donors give away over $45 million in donations, both large and small. This podcast series is meant to give you the tools you need to be effective in the world and fund nonprofits and issues that you care about with meaning and purpose, and to make a true, deep difference in the world. Talk to me first about how was it that, you know, this foundation in the Pacific Northwest reached out to you? Why did you say yes, I guess is the first question, and then we'll talk about the technical stuff later. But why did you say yes to moving into philanthropy after this experience on the ground of getting stuff done?
A woman named Dorothy Bullitt, whose husband died when she was still relatively young, had turned out to be a hugely successful businesswoman who served on a number of corporate boards, but her real success was in broadcasting. She started out because she loved classical music, and she bought a small FM radio station to bring classical music to the roughnecks in what was then a still pretty tough town of Seattle, and over time moved into AM radio and then into television and then into cable, into television production. And by the time that she passed, King Broadcasting was the dominant broadcasting force in the Pacific Northwest, and also remarkably progressive. It was the Seattle station was the first television station in the United States to editorialize against the war in Vietnam, and spectacularly successful commercially as well. She was not much of an environmentalist, though she did do a couple of things that were conservation oriented. She died, and the Bullitt children, who were always referred to as the children, though at the time of her death, I think the youngest was 67 or 68, decided to put a very large chunk of their inheritance into a foundation. They made that decision rather quickly before they decided what the foundation would do. And they took a year then to try to make a decision. They invited in various people to talk to them about what might be done on crime, what might be done on providing health care more broadly, what you could do with housing. And one of the fields that particularly a couple of the children, especially one, Harriet Bullitt, was really keen on having it be the environment. So in any case, I was invited in to give the pitch for what they could do as an environmental philanthropy. And I did. And I got a call a few days later. It's like a call from the senator's chief of staff asking, saying that they decided that they would like to become an environmental philanthropy and asking whether I would be willing to be the president. Their thought was that they would spend down the foundation over the course of about 10 years. They wanted to be basically spending the money while they were still alive. And so they asked me if I would become president, offered me a five-year contract. My daughter was a senior in high school that year. I had spent much of my life having to go out and raise my own salary as well as support organizations. You eat what you kill in the funding world as a nonprofit. The concept of working for something that had an endowment and I would have a solid salary and a pretty decent salary for the next 5 years while my kid went to college was very appealing. And also, I had had some remarkably bad experiences with foundations. And I thought it would be an interesting challenge to actually run one and see if we could do it in a way that future grantees wouldn't look at us and say they had remarkably bad experiences.
What were some of your remarkably bad experiences with other foundations?
I don't want to go into my twilight years making enemies and naming names, but I'll give you a really strong example. there was a small philanthropy that when I was running a group called Green Seal that was trying to determine which consumer products were environmentally superior to other consumer products and give a nice label to them that would let a consumer who cared about that make an easy choice, because it was an independent third-party certification. We asked the head of this small foundation a couple of times to just have meetings with us to discuss what it was that we were doing, because we thought that the donor behind that would be really interested, but we had no way to get through to the donor except through this guy. And he kept delaying it and pushing us off. He just wasn't much interested. We also at that point had a program-related loan from a very prominent foundation. It turned out we were likely to miss our initial repayment of that loan, and we wanted to explain why and see if we could get some extra time. That was a sufficiently large sum of money that it became pretty important. So we had the meeting set up. The foundation was in Chicago. We purchased non-refundable, so cheap airline tickets to go to it, and it was just a priority. Get a call from this small foundation executive and says, "Hey, I've got a time for you. Can you come in the day after tomorrow at 11 o'clock? And say, "Well, you know, we can come in today, tomorrow, 2 days after that, 3 days after that. I mean, basically, we're at your disposal, but you've chosen a time that means $500,000 to us for an appointment in Chicago that's been set up for a couple of months. And so you somehow nailed the one time that we can't do it." And there was silence on the phone for like 20, 30 seconds. He said, "Well, let me state this differently. If you have any genuine desire to get a grant from us, you will be here at whatever, 10 o'clock in the morning, the day after tomorrow." So we hustle and call the foundation in Chicago, who were very warm and charming, and said, "Sure, we can postpone it. Come on in the following week." We sacrificed the cost of the airplane tickets and showed up at this guy's office at 10 o'clock in the morning. And his receptionist expressed surprise that we were there. And turned out he had flown out of town to meet with his donor, who had called him and asked to have a meeting at the time that we were to meet with him, and hadn't even had the good faith, after being such a complete, to call us and let us know that he had to cancel the meeting.
Wow. All right. That's a really powerful story. So now let's get into some brass tacks around Bullet and your strategy. You know, what were some of the things that you feel are really important that people hear about, like why, and what were the successes that you really are proud of there?
There is a question of legitimacy about who gets to make what kinds of decisions or shape what kinds of decisions society has. If you're a member of a legislative body and you've been elected, or if you're an administrator who was appointed by somebody elected, you can get some kind of legitimacy from the fact that the public has chosen to move in this direction. But for many foundations, why somebody who was successful in a software company, or maybe whose grandfather was a successful entrepreneur in the pharmaceutical industry, should have the ability to send large sums of money in some direction that seems to them to be good, has always struck me as being wrong. And so one of the things that appealed to me about the Bullets is that they were prepared to not be a family foundation, but to be a private foundation with a diverse board of directors that would have terms, would rotate with some degree of frequency, and would draw broadly from all of the different constituencies that would be potential grantees or who would be influenced by the impacts of the various programs that we establish if we were successful. And that, I think, is really important in philanthropy, that there is some tendency on the part of a fair number of foundations, and without even naming names, you can kind of guess who I'm talking about if you talk about vast sums of money that have a board that consists of one man and his spouse, or maybe one man, his spouse, and his child. And generally from a background that has absolutely nothing to do with the area in which they are going to be spending their money. So I found that very appealing. And the decision to go into the Emerald Corridor, which was a decision that the board played an active role in deciding, was that kind of a decision. The Bullets had initially intended to spend down their endowment over 10 years. Then we had the dot-com craze. The endowment swelled like crazy. At a time when we were giving away far more than was required by the IRS, we actually grew our endowment by almost 50% rather than spending it down. And then we, again, with great luck, got out of most of the investments that were skyrocketing before they then collapsed when that bubble burst. And so we found ourselves with substantially more money 8 or 10 years into it than we had at the start, still with the sense that we would eventually spend down, but that it would not be on that initial timetable. However, we were continuing to spend at rates that were causing us to have a smaller endowment every year, and we could continue, we felt, to do our original geographical focus if we wanted to, but that was Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Western Montana, Western British Columbia, and Southeastern Alaska. We were a tiny foundation and getting tinier. And that was just spreading grants to the point where they were becoming so small that it wouldn't be at the noise level. But there were a lot of groups that if they got our $10,000 or didn't get it, it made no difference at all. Whereas if we constrained ourselves to a lesser geographic area, we could make much more substantial and much more strategic gifts. And that would be the proximate cause, the but-for cause of something big happening. That if we were not there and prepared to take this kind of a risk on this kind of a grant, the outcome probably would not occur. And I've always found that appealing. If you're going to be a foundation, although the ideology now is you should just give general operating support to everyone so that the foundation grant just becomes merged with all the membership money, and the people that run the organization just then have that much greater budget. It seems to me to not play into the greatest strength of a foundation, which is to allow organizations to do something that they'd love to do, but that they would not be able to do, but for the foundation becoming engaged. So Emerald Corridor, that was a decision to try to focus ourselves in those areas where the greatest number of people live, where we could have some political impacts, and where we would be, let me say one other precursor. A large amount of money was coming into environmental philanthropy in the Northwest, and much of that money was being focused upon conservation issues rather than urban and human environmental issues. So we were, up to that point, scattered across them. In fact, when I first arrived at the foundation, a huge fraction of our effort was going into trying to save the ancient forests, which were rapidly being shredded. But now that was more and more being covered. In fact, there are a couple of philanthropies that it would not be too big an exaggeration to say that the farther away you are from the nearest human settlement, the more likely they are to fund you. And this was also at a time when there was getting to be more and more environmental opposition, and we wanted to make sure that we were doing things that were relevant in population centers where we could get votes to could be pro-environment votes. So with all of that, the environmental corridor was basically a focus upon the big three cities west of the Cascades, Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver, British Columbia. And to try to do things that would help make those cities and those greater metropolitan areas models of green sustainability. And in part, that was driven by opportunism. They were already cities that had people who were pro-environment. There were city council members, mayors, county executives. And if we could provide a grassroots base of support to let them be stronger, then we might be able to do some things that would become interesting models for other parts of the country.
And Dennis, I mean, just hearing your life story before, it almost feels like you're coming, so that you had this massive, you were part of course, it's not only you, it's a huge coalition. You were part of a massive national sort of reckoning with environmentalism and made huge strides in the 70s. And there was a pushback nationally around this. And it's really interesting to hear that part and now hear your story at Bullet, where you are focusing more locally on solutions that bring people into the mix. Because in the beginning of your journey, you were talking about how the origins of the quote unquote environmental movement were really moms who were seeing places they used to swim not being able to bring their kids there again, or their air quality getting so bad that their kids are getting asthma, or freeways being built into their communities. And I just love this full circle. And you know, I've known you for so many years, but I haven't been able to sit down with you like this before. It makes sense that you're now looking at a region and saying, well, how do we now bring people into this conversation? Is my observation right there, or do you want to add to that?
No, I think the observation is right. I suppose the other element, and this is a little bit ambiguous, but not entirely, is that the larger the entity that you're talking about, the less certain the outcome of a policy initiative will be. I mean, by the time you get to the United Nations, the United Nations peacekeeping forces are notorious for their inability to keep peace. The United Nations Environmental Program has no enforcement capabilities, it has limited technical capabilities, it's not really much of a player. Even nuclear regulatory efforts of the United Nations to try to stop weapons are not very effective. If you look at the way they do their inspections, it's just sad. They have to give notice to people before they come, and then people modify stuff and they don't really know what's going on when they try to stop nuclear proliferation. You get down to the national level and you can pass laws and you've got some levels of enforcement, but the federal agency inside Washington, D.C. can't really monitor everything that's going on every place in the country. And you pass the law and it really sounds like it's going to be changing things dramatically. And you come back 20 years later and in some places it's had some effect, in other places it's just been completely ignored. And I wanted, at a personal level, as I got to later stages in my life, to actually be there where I had a little bit of dirt under my fingernails and had a sense of what was really happening on the ground. When we tried to do stuff at the Bullet Foundation, it was pretty clear whether we succeeded or we failed. And that kind of accountability I found attractive.
I love that. And so, Dennis, can you tell me about what it is? And I mean, I know that Bullet is now spent down and it's closed, so I'll talk about it in past tense. But when you were talking to a nonprofit, what was it when you talked to someone and you got super psyched about them? Like, what were the qualities of the conversation that would drive home in the back of your mind? You're saying this group is going to get a grant most likely. Like, what are the key qualities you look for in a nonprofit when it's talking to you about a project it wants you to fund?
I'm looking for, and this is sort of in opposition to the ideology that I had when I was a young person, but I'm looking for a leader who will move heaven and earth not to fail, who is deeply committed to the success of whatever it is that they are trying to do, who will feel beyond horrible if they are not successful. Want somebody who commands the respect of this organization. Want somebody who knows the field that they're operating in. If you ask them a couple of even slightly complicated questions, shows that they know something about, you know, as the case may be, the chemistry, the physics, the economics of what it is that they're trying to accomplish. Someone who has done ideally one or two things in the past but has been successful, so that, you know, it's not just what they say, but there's a track record. Looking for somebody who, when you're watching him or her with the staff of the organization, is respected by the organization. I realize that this places an awful lot of burden upon an individual, but I've come to believe that that really is a hugely important part of success. And so I'm looking for that person who gives me the confidence that something will succeed. Another thing that I like, but that isn't and maybe shouldn't be a part of all philanthropy or even most philanthropy, but I have a psychological desire frequently to swing for the bleachers. If I'm going to use a sports analogy, come at bat five times, you can get on first base pretty easily if you score a bunt, but getting on first base doesn't really accomplish anything. It just moves you a little bit ahead. I'm looking for somebody who maybe instead of having five bunts gets one home run. And you seldom come across that in philanthropy, but when I see somebody who has an idea that is transformational, I find that enormously appealing. A guy came into the office one day talking about deep green buildings, which he referred to as living buildings, and how you could structure something so that it was able to manage itself on the energy that felt on its roof, transferred by photovoltaics into electricity, got all of its water from the rain that fell on its roof, treated its sewage inside the building, had the ability to regulate its temperature somewhat passively, and on and on. It had nothing that was toxic in any of the building materials in it. That was a guy named Jason McLennan. He was pushing what became the International Living Future Institute, designed the Living Building Challenge, and created the framework that not only did we fund him for a long time and go with him to meet with other foundations that we were trying to persuade to join us in funding them, but it became the basis on which we built the Bullitt Center to try to become what was, even 10 years later, may still be the greenest commercial building in the world. So it's a swing for the bleachers. Relatively few buildings will do all of those things, but by proving that we can do all of them in a way that makes economic sense and that is relatively attractive and very comfortable and very productive for the people inside, you can do something that people will say, well, I'm not prepared to jump in the deep end of the pool, but I'm prepared to harvest all of the rain that falls on my roof and store it in cisterns down in the basement and use it for everything, including potable drinking water for the building. I think that's one important way that we move the ball forward.
I love that, because you're talking about not just giving a grant, but helping an entire movement move forward.
Yeah, and then also hiring a hugely knowledgeable and enthusiastic person from the University of Washington to give tours of the building to visiting architects, building engineers, developers, people who come from various kinds of government. And we've had the largest real estate developer in China come three times to the Bullitt Center. And it's making sure that you not only do it and succeed, but that you try to then have an impact. And I will say that even through COVID, when work from home became pretty common, we were able to keep the Bullitt Center operating in the black. It has made money every year and has produced more electricity than it fed into the grid, more electricity every year than it used.
That's great. So one thing you talk about here is the fact that in your experience with Bullitt, you gave grants, but you did more than that. I mean, the family had funds through the foundation that you ran. They had private funds that didn't have to do with the foundation where they could do more political giving. You built a building. Well, Bullitt Foundation built a building. You worked locally with folks to really help make a significant difference in the Pacific Northwest to, as an example for the world, really, around how we can transition to a renewable and resilient community that is navigating and it's trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So you're doing all of those things within the foundation. And then the whole idea around spending down and then also having a diverse board that's not only family, those are other pieces that I think that are interesting approaches that Bullitt has had over the years. And you did these things before they became trends in philanthropy. So I just want to say that out loud. The other thing you didn't mention that I watched you do that I'd love you to talk about is you very early on were really deliberative about hiring staff from very diverse backgrounds. And that is important because a lot of foundations, they didn't do that as well or as deliberatively until recently. Talk to me about that experience as well.
Well, somewhat based upon some unfortunate experiences that I'd had when I was on the other side of the desk asking foundations for support, I've tried to emphasize to the staff, and mostly they have been people who have themselves been on the other side of the desk, so they can identify with what the challenges are for grantees and empathize with them. And can one offer some guidance that they may have had some experience that's relevant to some challenges that the grantees are facing. In fact, I've had a couple of people who grantees have sought me out to say how incredibly valuable it was that the program officer came to a couple of their planning sessions where he was able to explain some of the experiences that he'd had in analogous situations before. And it was just, they said, hugely helpful to them. Another thing that we've tried to inculcate, and I think successfully across the board with the staff, is a degree of humility, a recognition that you give money to grantees because grantees have a mission, they've got dedication, they are often sacrificing something in their lives to be able to do something. And you should hear them out, not be interrupting them, not say, no, you really ought to do this instead. You know, I talked about the living building challenge. Nobody inside the foundation would have ever come up with that idea. And a big part of what philanthropy should be, I think, if it does it well, is to develop an ability to, you can really overstate this, but to act like venture capitalists who don't go out and build companies, but they recognize powerful ideas. They put some money behind it. They sometimes serve on their boards and in all cases, at least offer them advice. But you do that recognizing that you are not the entrepreneur. You are not the inventor. You are the person that's trying to facilitate their ability to be as impactful as they can be.
I love that, Dennis. So you've spent down your, I don't want to call it retired because you're very active, but Bullitt Foundation is now sunset. What's your advice to us out there in the world who are still actively giving money away to worthy causes on the environmental side? Tell me, give your advice. Tell it, you're passing the torch to us. What do you think we should be thinking about?
Well, the spend down thing is interesting. It involves, among other things, an act of faith that other people are going to be creating new fortunes in the future and that some of them will be philanthropic and that they will fit into any voids that your absence means. In the case of Bullitt, it was just straightforward. When I arrived, we had 85 million. At our peak, we grew that to like something over 140 million. And then as we began spending at a significantly greater rate than we were growing in the latter years, it started getting smaller and smaller, so that if you were to make grants at a level that allowed you to continue in perpetuity, the grants budget would be sufficiently small that your impacts would be limited. You'd have trouble finding and retaining staff who are prepared to operate at such a small scale. And then finally, there are a whole series of issues that come and get resolved. And once they're resolved, you've either won or you've lost. But if you've lost, you've probably lost permanently. And we wanted to be able to play at a level that let us have more wins than losses. So all of those things for us meant we should spend it down. If we were something the size of, you know, the Gates Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, that might be a totally different calculus. But for us, it was a smart thing to do.
I hope you all enjoyed that interview and the conversation that I had with Dennis about the main strategies that the Bullitt Foundation had in terms of how to give its money away as effectively as possible. And I hope that you learn from him and you'll pick up some of the ideas that he brought up that you think could be applicable to your own giving strategy. I hope you have a wonderful day. And until next time, do your good and be well. So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed making it for you. So if you want to find out more about what I have to offer, please check out www.doyourgood.com and learn more ways to make your money matter. Until next time, do your good and be well.